Hear the word of God in the Gospel of John, chapter 12, verses 1 through 11. Six days before the Passover, Jesus came to Bethany where Lazarus was, whom Jesus had raised from the dead. There they made him a supper. Martha served, and Lazarus was one of those at table with him. Mary took a pound of costly ointment of pure nard and anointed the feet of Jesus and wiped his feet with her hair. And the house was filled with the fragrance of the ointment. But Judas Iscariot, one of his disciples, he who was to betray him, said, "Why was this ointment not sold for 300 denarii and given to the poor?" This he said, not that he cared for the poor, but because he was a thief, as he had the money box and he used to take what was put into it. Jesus said, "Let her alone. Let her keep it for the day of my burial. The poor you always have with you, but you do not always have me." When the great crowd of the Jews learned that he was there, they came not only on account of Jesus, but also to see Lazarus, whom he had raised from the dead. So the chief priests planned to put Lazarus also to death, because on account of him, many of the Jews were going away and believing in Jesus. Our study of the Gospel of John has taken us more than a year now, and we're just past the midway point in the book. In that study, we have gone from the beginning of beginnings, an undated point in eternity past, up to the eve of the week of Jesus' crucifixion. So in 10 chapters, we have covered eternity and most of the 33 years of Jesus' earthly life. Now we look to the last 10 chapters. 10 chapters which cover not a broad expanse of years in eternity, but which cover just over 1 week in time, but quite a week. A week far more significant and really far more important than the week of creation or the week of Jesus' birth, because the week that is covered in the last 10 chapters of the Gospel of John is the week of Jesus' death. Here we are at the eve of that week. We open our Bibles to John 12 and we find that Jesus has daringly come to Bethany. Bethany in the environs of Jerusalem, less than 2 miles away, a suburb. I say daringly because there was a warrant out for his arrest with the anticipation that when arrested, he would be quickly tried and executed. Everyone knew it. The word was in the streets, and Jesus knew it as well. Those powerful political and religious leaders had already decided to kill him. And even though there were those kinds of threats, Jesus, with his disciples reluctantly following behind, went the walk from a place called Ephraim, north of Jerusalem, to Bethany. Went to a Thanksgiving dinner, a dinner that had Jesus and Lazarus as the guests of honor, and had Martha as the hostess and the caterer of the affair. Interestingly, according to the account, Lazarus was as much an attraction as Jesus. And you would expect it to be so, because the word was out that Lazarus had been dead 4 days and now had been raised to life, and people came by the dozens, by the scores, the hundreds, maybe even by the thousands, just to see him. Much like what has happened this past week across America with the return of the hostages. People want to get out and see. See those people who have been captive and now have been set free. And with an equal curiosity, those ancient people went to see the man who was a hostage of death and now had come back to life again. How typical that those who have been given new life by Jesus Christ attract others to come close to Jesus Christ. Well, what happened raised all kinds of problems for these political religious leaders called Sadducees. All kinds of things. You see, there was insurrection in the air, and they were afraid that the Roman legions would quickly and swiftly come down and crush that insurrection, and with that crushing of the insurrection, they would lose their position and their power and their prestige, and everything would be altered. So they didn't want that kind of insurrection. They were concerned about the religious things that were happening because Jesus was purported to be the Messiah, sent from God. And they were upset because their rather definite and strong theological teachings were being countermanded. You see, they taught that there was no life after death. And that's hard to teach when a dead man is walking around telling you that he was 4 days dead and now he's alive again. So they decided that they would kill Jesus, but then they added to the plot, typical of a criminal mind in any period of time, they decided that if their testimony would be contradicted, the best thing to do would be to destroy the evidence, kill Jesus and kill Lazarus as well, and then they would be home free and things would be the way they were before. Yes, it's quite a story. John 12, a story of plot, of intrigue, of love, of friendship, of miracle, of sin and of treachery and betrayal. A mixture. Somewhat like a garden. A garden that has weeds and a garden that has flowers. And yet in it there is a flower that really stands out as a very special and beautiful blossom, higher and more significant than all the others. It is the flower of the love of Mary, Mary of Bethany, who so specially loved Jesus. Mark tells us that on this occasion, Jesus is recorded as saying, "Truly I say to you, wherever the gospel is preached in the whole world, what she has done will be told in memory of her." See it, smell it, admire it, touch it, behold. Behold the beauty of loving Jesus. What we'll do this morning is gently, tenderly, pluck some petals from the flower of Mary's love and examine them. The first petal is the petal of knowledge. We set it there and we look at it carefully, seeing that Jesus indicated that Mary knew something the others didn't know, that she clearly knew and understood that soon Jesus would die and that soon he would be buried. What's amazing is that those 12 special disciples, those men who followed Jesus everywhere, didn't know and didn't understand. If we were to page back in our Bibles to the parallel account in the 10th chapter of Mark, we would discover in verses 33 and 34 the words which Jesus spoke as they walked to that Thanksgiving dinner at the house of Lazarus and Mary and Martha. Listen to what Jesus said to them. He said, "Behold, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered to the chief priests and to the scribes, and they will condemn him to death and deliver him to the Gentiles and will mock him and spit on him and scourge him and kill him, and after 3 days he will rise." I can hardly imagine anything clearer. But they didn't know it. They didn't understand it. Just a week later in the Garden of Gethsemane, they were sound asleep on the eve of the greatest event in all of history. On the day of crucifixion, they were bewildered. They were threatened and frightened into retreat until they sought to escape from Jesus, who had taught them the greatest truth that has ever been taught. They didn't know and they didn't understand, but Mary did. Why was she different? How did she know what the disciples didn't even know? It seems to me that the secret is told in the frequent picture that is painted of Mary in the Gospels. We first find her in Luke 10:39, where she is sitting at the feet of Jesus, listening. Just listening. Apparently, Mary frequently took the opportunity to spend time with Jesus and just to listen to him. That's the way she knew. She listened. And because she knew, she loved him in a way that others did not love him. Do you love him? Do you love Jesus? How well do you know him? For the way to love him is to know him. And the way to know him is to spend time listening to him. Ralph Kuyper is a well-known Bible teacher who was a seminary professor of mine. He tells the story how some years back, a young man was riding in a train with a well-known Bible teacher, a man who was his mentor and whom he admired greatly. The young man was reading the newspaper, and he put it down and turned toward his older friend who was there reading the Bible as the train sped along the tracks. And he said to him, "Sir, I wish I knew the Bible as you do." And gently and graciously, the older man turned to his young friend and said, "You'll never get to know it by reading the newspaper." The young man put down the newspaper and picked up his Bible and began to study it. Study it until it became a way of life for him, and he too became a powerful Bible teacher for Jesus Christ named Donald Gray Barnhouse. Barnhouse was used of God in a powerful, significant, far-reaching way. You see, to love him, we must know him. And to know him, we must listen to him. I've been excited to hear spontaneously scores of people tell me that they have written down or committed to a goal in 1981 of reading the Bible through. And I'm excited to hear that. Because the way to know him is to spend time in his word, to read it, to have a time every day when we study what the Bible has to say, and when we talk to our Lord in prayer. And when we listen to him, we will then know him as Mary knew him, and when we know him, we will then love him. Because to truly love Jesus, we must spend time getting to know him. And the way to get to know him is through his word. There's a second petal that we pluck from the flower of Mary's love. It's the petal of extravagance. The Bible tells us that Mary took a pound of extremely expensive perfume and poured it out on Jesus' feet. That it cost 300 denarii, which was a year's wages. What would that be in today's economy? $10,000, $15,000, maybe $20,000. Here she wasn't asked. She didn't explain. She just did it. Nobody thought much of Mary being at Jesus' feet because she was often at Jesus' feet. And so inconspicuously, almost spontaneously, almost secretly, she took this vial of perfume and poured it out, it having a value of perhaps $15,000. That's the way love is, though. It doesn't count the cost. It doesn't calculate the value. Because love is so fixed on the one who is loved that the greatest of extravagances really doesn't seem like very much at all. It seems to me that we are often not guilty of such extravagance. That we often do count the cost, that we figure with calculator in hand what 10% is, or we consider our gifts in terms of an income tax return, or our schedule in terms of the time that might be available between other appointments. But it wasn't that way for Mary. She believed and she evidenced that extravagant love does not count the cost. What's the most valuable thing that you have? What would be comparable in your life to the perfume, the ointment that Mary had? Your job? Your pension? Or life savings? Or a house? Or a car? Or a friend? Or your body? Or your children? Or husband? Or wife? Or parents? What's the most valuable possession of all? And would you be willing to just pour it out on Jesus as an extravagant act of love? Some years ago, a motion picture was made of O. Henry's famous story, The Gift of the Magi. I'm sure most of you know the story well. It's about a young married couple named Jim and Della. They really didn't have much of anything. They could barely afford to eat and to live and to maintain the rent on their apartment. It was Christmas time, and there was nothing to buy gifts for one another. All they had were two precious possessions. Della had magnificent long flowing hair, and Jim had a gold watch that his father had given to him. Della, on Christmas Eve, went to the shop of a wig maker and for $20 sold her hair and had it cut short. And with that money, she went and she bought a chain for Jim's gold watch. He came to the apartment that night and was absolutely dumbstruck to see that her hair was shorn short. Not only because her hair had been magnificent, it had been beautiful, but also because he had sold his watch to buy combs, expensive jeweled combs, for Della's hair. Now some would say, what a waste! What an ironic waste that they get rid of the two most precious things that they have, and then there's no use for either. Do you know? Only someone who has never been in love would call that a waste. Such extravagant love. It is no waste to give the best you have for the one that you love with all of your heart. Do you love Jesus? Then love him extravagantly. We pluck a third petal from the flower of Mary's love. It's the petal of humility. John emphasizes in verse 3 that Mary anointed Jesus' feet. In those ancient days, the significant thing to do was to anoint someone's head. Most of us have memorized as children the 23rd Psalm, "Thou anointest my head with oil." To wash someone's feet or to anoint someone's feet, well, that was the task of a slave or a servant. The lowest and most menial of undertakings in that ancient Oriental society. But Mary wasn't pouring out that perfume to get attention or honor for herself. She wanted all that to go to Jesus. And so she sat quietly and humbly at his feet, where she had been so many times before, and as inconspicuously as she could, as if the world contained only her and Jesus alone, she poured out that perfume. And I suspect that if Mary could be here this morning, she would be embarrassed that we're talking about her this way. She would come and whisper in our ears and say, "Don't look down at me. Look up at him. Isn't he beautiful? Isn't he magnificent? Don't you love him? You can't help but love him." When Harry Ironside was the pastor of Moody Memorial Church in Chicago, he told about a high-level business executive in Chicago who was a wealthy and by then an elderly man, who invested a significant amount of money in the establishment of a rescue mission in one of the seedier sections of the city of Chicago. Totally unbeknownst to his business colleagues and, as best I understand, to his family as well, he used to go every Saturday with old clothes on and scrub the floors and wash the chairs at that rescue mission. After years of doing this, one day through a set of unusual circumstances and coincidences, some of his colleagues, other executives at that corporation, vice presidents, visited the mission and, to their astonishment, found the president of the corporation, their boss, on his knees in old clothes scrubbing the floor. They immediately asked him to get up and said they would hire someone else to take on the task, that they would do it themselves, but he ought then stop quickly. That godly old man's answer was, "Please do not stop me. I want to do it for Jesus' sake." That's the petal of humility on the flower of love. When we love Him, our thoughts are not of ourselves, of our success or accomplishments. Our thoughts are of Him, of Jesus Christ. And when we extravagantly give our best for Him, we seek not our attention and glory. We seek His attention and His glory. A fourth petal on the flower of Mary's love is the petal that we shall call abandon. Mary did a very strange thing when she used her hair to wipe Jesus' feet. You see, in ancient days, the strict custom of Palestine was that a woman would never, ever think of appearing in public with her hair unbound. The strict custom was that the day a girl was married, her hair was bound up tight on her head. And until the day she died, the only people that ever would see her hair unbound and long were her husband and her immediate family. In fact, if in ancient Jerusalem you were to see a woman walking down the street with her hair unbound, that was the sure sign that she was an immoral woman. Apparently, though, Mary never thought of that. Again, it was as if she and Jesus were the only ones in her world, and she loved Him so much that she was absolutely spontaneous in her actions toward Him. She did what would please Him, regardless of what other people might say, independent of what other people might think. She disregarded convention and custom for Jesus' sake. And I'm sure that love is always that way. It's unselfconscious. Love abandons convention to do whatever will please and serve the lover. Who cares what other people say? Who cares what other people think? It's what He says. It's what He thinks. That's what's important. That's the way it was for Mary. And that's the way it is for us too. When we love Jesus Christ with all of our hearts, we love Him with abandon. We're primarily concerned about what pleases Him and what impresses Him and what He wants and what He likes. And so when we're in a social situation or a business context or at school, if He would be pleased by our speaking His name, if He is pleased by our doing this or that, that is what we will do and that is what we will speak, even if it flies in the face of custom and convention. Because we love Him. We love Him extravagantly. So it is that when we accept Him, and when we are baptized, and when we confess Him, and when we serve Him, and when we live for Him, we do it with abandon, 10,000 times more concerned about what He thinks than the thoughts of anyone else around us. What an ecstasy to love Jesus with the abandon of Mary of Bethany. A fifth petal on the flower of Mary's love is the petal of fragrance. Verse 3 tells us that the house was filled with the fragrance of the ointment. Everywhere Jesus walked, the fragrance went with Him. Everywhere Mary went, because the fragrance was in her hair, the fragrance went to the kitchen, into the dining room, into the bedrooms. Wherever she traveled, there the fragrance went along. You couldn't escape it. The fragrance that was the evidence of Mary's extravagant love for Jesus. In the winter of 1972, Charlene and I visited a perfume shop near the American Embassy in Cairo, Egypt. I learned a lot of things about perfume that I didn't know before. For example, that which they sell there, they call essence. And what it is the oil base from which perfume is made. And it's diluted. It's diluted with one part of that oil base or essence to 10 parts of alcohol, and that's what makes the perfume. And there in that shop that fits every stereotype of what an Oriental bazaar would be like, we sat and had all the samples, not all of them, but a lot of samples of the perfume. There were those hanging tapestries and thick rugs and pillows on the floor upon which we sat. And the proprietor of that shop put dabs of the essence on our hands and on our arms. The place was simply saturated with the fragrance of all of those essences that there were shared with us and had been shared with thousands of others before us. We left that place, went back to the Shepherd's Hotel and tried to wash it off. And let me tell you, it doesn't wash off. And you can scrub and take baths and showers, and it's still there. And you get on the plane and you fly out of Cairo, and the stewardess, when she comes by your seat, you know, she looks at you and offers you the meal and sniffs you. It's downright embarrassing. The fragrance stays with you for days. Wherever you go, no matter what you do, is the lingering fragrance of having the essence of that perfume shop placed upon you. And so it was with Mary and with Jesus. You see, there was no escaping the sweet fragrance of her extravagant love for Jesus Christ, the Son of God. In fact, that sweet fragrance lingers even now, almost 2,000 years later. Jesus wanted it that way. He wanted, can you imagine, this story in particular, wherever the gospel is preached, wherever men and women in all of history are told that God became a man and that he died on the cross and rose again, this story is to accompany the preaching of the gospel. And so it wafts down through the centuries into our time, and we smell it still. The sweet, lingering fragrance of Mary's love, her extravagant love for Jesus Christ. Do you know that when we love Jesus this way, the exact same thing happens? Everywhere you go, the fragrance goes with you. Businessmen take it with them into the office, and salesmen take that fragrance of Jesus on calls. And the homemaker takes the fragrance of Jesus as Mary of Bethany into kitchen and dining room, living room and bedroom. Everywhere you go, it cannot be escaped. The sweet, lingering fragrance of those who have extravagantly loved Jesus Christ. And then there is a sixth petal that we pluck from the flower of Mary's love. It's a dark one, much darker than all the rest. One that I suppose if we were designing the flower, we may have left off. For the last petal is the petal of criticism. What Mary did, she did for Jesus only. Frankly, I doubt that she counted the cost. I doubt that she logically thought it through. I doubt that she considered the implications. I doubt that she even began to imagine what other people might think. Here, again, as if it were Mary and Jesus alone, and all the world was but a dream, she gave her all, she gave her best, extravagantly, humbly, with abandon, based on the knowledge she had, she just poured it out for Jesus. And then Judas spoke the first words of his recorded in Scripture, and he says, "Why wasn't this perfume sold for $15,000 and given to the poor?" Answered him. The other gospel records say that he spoke a second time. And pointing to Mary into the feet of Jesus, he said, "Why this waste?" And Mary's heart must have sunk. She never thought of it that way before. Her mind had been so filled with Jesus, her heart so full of love for him. She hadn't thought of the poor. She hadn't thought of the purse. She hadn't thought of the problems. She hadn't thought of any of those things at all. She just loved Jesus and wanted to show him. And now she was the object of sarcastic criticism. You've been there. I've been there. You speak a word. You teach a lesson. You preach a sermon. You go an extra mile. You give a special gift. You send a note. You make a phone call. You give your very, very, very best for Jesus. And someone then cuts you deeply with harsh criticism. And worst of all, the harsh criticism of a fellow disciple. Oh, I know there are rational explanations. Sure there are. Legitimate ones. There's the rational explanation that the critic speaks as he does because he has a problem. Judas had a problem. He was a thief. He wanted the money in the kitty so he could steal it out. It was Judas' problem. The criticism wasn't valid. There was the rational explanation that Mary really did care about the poor, that she had evidenced it before and she would evidence it again. But this one time, she was just pouring out her best for Jesus. And there was the rational explanation that Jesus is the final arbiter of the evaluation of acts. And he is the one that says it really matters what she did, and she did that which was right. Yes, there are rational explanations. But the criticism still hurts. Hurts more deeply than ever you could tell. Remember. Remember that when you love Jesus Christ with all of your heart, as Mary loved Jesus. Remember that when you serve Jesus Christ with your very best, as Mary served Jesus, that there will always be critics. But love him nonetheless. Don't let the critics rob you of the joy of knowing him. Don't let the critics steal from you the ecstasy of loving him with extravagance. Don't let the critics take away your loving him in humility and with abandon. Don't, because of critics, quash the lingering fragrance of extravagant love for the Savior. Frederick Whitfield is credited with writing the simple words of an old hymn. There is a name I love to hear. I love to sing its worth. It sounds like music to my ear, the sweetest name on earth. Oh, how I love Jesus. Oh, how I love Jesus. Oh, how I love Jesus. Because he first loved me. Behold the beauty. Behold the beauty of loving Jesus. And like Mary of Bethany, may the sweet fragrance of your extravagant love for him fill your house and be told wherever the gospel is preached. Let's stand to pray. In some ways, Lord, it seems as if our focus today has been on one of your disciples. But as we see her, our eyes are turned toward your Son. Oh, how we love him. We love him with all our hearts. Lord, our prayer is that we, by your grace, would love him knowingly, extravagantly, with abandon. May the sweet fragrance, the beautiful fragrance of our love for your precious Son permeate everywhere that we go, at home, at school, at church, on the street, or in the car. May that lingering fragrance be sensed by all. Oh Lord, enable us to love him extravagantly, who far, far more extravagantly first loved us.